Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to another episode of Your Case is on Hold, number 88. We are here representing JBJS, but the views are our own and do not represent JBJS. I am Antonia Chen, executive editor at JBJS, and I have here...
I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Methods.
So without further ado, we want to say thank you to JBJS CME. This is sponsored by them. If you need CME, if you need credit to learn, go to the JBJS, and you will learn a lot of information to get your continuing medical education credits. Without further ado, we're going to go to top of the pile. What's new in limb lengthening and deformity correction by Flanagan and Kahn? It's permanently free. Incidence and prediction of postoperative urinary retention following lumbar decompression by Quas et al. There's also an institutional large language model for musculoskeletal MRI improves protocol adherence and accuracy by Helenon et al. Of mice and men. Nice play on a book. Temporal comparisons of femoral shaft fracture healing after intramedullary nailing by Jiang et al.
And suppose that they're nailing mice femurs or something?
Yeah, of mice and men. That's where the correlation is. Isn't that kind of a cute correlation there? I thought it was kind of...
I don't generally think that journalistic titles are that good for scientific work. I usually say, like, you know, it could have been just fine with temporal comparison of femoral shaft fracture healing after intramedullary nailing. We don't need the
extra information.
It's not even extra information. It's just like, you know, like tongue in cheek, little werewolves in the OR. Does facial hair cause infection? Like, you know, it's like orthopedic Tatler or the Inquirer.
They did compare radiographs of mice and human femoral fractures. And they said they were to quantify and compare the temporal progression of fracture healing in mice and humans. Because mice are not humans and humans are not mice.
Yeah. How does the healing of mice femurs help inform patient care for humans?
It's a good question. I think when it comes to like infection work, for example, like mice are not a hugely great model necessarily because they're able to wall off infection.
Yeah, so no, fracture models. I think mice are good for incubating tissue engineered constructs.
They are.
And like, then you need a larger animal model for good fracture comparison. Yeah. Caprahercus, the Spanish goat, or rabbit models for spinal fusion, or I mean, probably people don't really like using dog models, but I think dog models for femur fractures or tibial fractures and things like that.
So cheap, a lot of good stuff.
Yeah.
So anyway, all right. Next is orthopedic manifestations in hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome by Eichinger et al. The timing of direct oral anticoagulant usage did not impact outcomes following hip arthroplasty for femoral neck fractures by Chen et al., not me. This is a Mayo paper. The utility of a prediction model using neurological examination findings for diagnosing degenerative cervical myelopathy by Funaba et al. And there's three evidence-based orthopedic articles. One is GLP-1 receptor agonist in orthopedic surgery, implications for perioperative care and outcomes, an orthopedic surgeon's perspective by Ramathanan. Evaluating artificial intelligence-based writing assistance among published orthopedic studies, detection and trends for future interpretation by Callanan et al. With a commentary with it. And finally, AOA Critical Issues Symposium, how are orthopedic leaders chosen? Competency versus Kingmaker by Weber, Loria, and Marx. Without further ado, let's go ahead into our headlines. You're going to talk about the cost-effectiveness of continuous pressure measurement in the diagnosis of acute compartment syndrome by Buchlock et al. With an infographic attached to it.
Yes. So this is a very interesting study that is a cost-effectiveness analysis. They do a very good job of following the tenets of classic cost-effectiveness papers. So if you're looking for a primer or something to model your future cost-effectiveness work on, I think you can kind of use this as a substrate they really do touch on all the most critical points that you would want to see in a cost-effective analysis, including sensitivity tests using deterministic and probabilistic approaches, and assessing in a high quality a way as possible. And we will get to that, the parameters around which cost-effectiveness in this domain would be defined. So, as we heard in the title, this is about the diagnosis of acute compartment syndrome. And they want to assess continuous pressure measurement versus kind of the standard of care practices. And they've done some preliminary work on this. So they are, I think, clearly proponents of the continuous pressure measurement in the diagnosis of compartment syndrome. And their stance is that continuous pressure measurement has higher specificity. Therefore, it avoids unnecessary fasciotomies. In conditions like the typical traditional approach for conditions with acute compartment syndrome, conditions that result in long-term, potentially devastating physiologic, neurologic, functional effects, is that you want to have a high sensitivity. You'd rather be doing more than what's necessary versus doing less. Like, I don't know about your, third year surgical clerkship, but there was like this maxim among like the general surgeons that was like, if you're not aggressive enough on appendicitis, if you're not taking out some normal appendices.
Lean margins is the idea.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I thought that was an interesting paradigm because, they're really focused on the specificity, and that's sort of their angle here is that we want to avoid unnecessary fasciotomies, which of course you do, but you wouldn't want to avoid unnecessary fasciotomies at the expense of missing compartment syndrome, right? So the first problem with that I think with the cost effectiveness is that it's kind of like a one-way thing. It's like assuming that no adverse events from this approach are really happening. It's all just to the avoiding unnecessary surgery, not, oh, we also, missed a few and there are patients with catastrophic effects. That's very hard to model in, it's not a critique of the study per se. It's more of, kind of the outlook and how you might apply this in clinical practice. So, the first thing that you learn, and part of my K was in cost effectiveness analyses. So the first thing that you learn formally when you're talking about modeling cost effectiveness is that everyone says, all models are wrong, but some are useful. So this is just, it's an academic exercise. It's sort of as experimental as experimental can be. And you can take with it what you will. The first thing was, each cohort, they assume to comprise a mix of tibial plateau and tibial shaft fractures, which I think that was an unnecessary misstep. The substrate doesn't really, it doesn't matter what the fracture is that's causing the compartment syndrome. So just have one, I would say, and that eliminates some additional, unnecessary variation around this. So then they said the accuracy of continuous pressure measurement was based on their recent clinical trial data, or at least I believe is partially developed from their work, while the accuracy of the others was based on a weighted average of multiple retrospective reports, some of which, have small samples. So they've got much higher quality data around how their preferred approach performs versus the comparison group. And then the other thing in this kind of situation is that, as they recognize, acute compartment syndrome is very rare. And because of that rarity, you're not going to have like these overwhelming quality adjusted life years that come out of whatever intervention you want to have, really. So, their gain in qualities is like minuscule. It's like incredibly small. And that results in the net monetary benefits being very, very modest. We're talking about the net benefit of about $3,000 and, less than $5,000 over the lifetime of the patient. That's in, medical health expenditures is almost like a rounding error. And they are, talking about dominance, which they do have scenarios where it is dominant, which means like it's basically, it's cheaper and superior. But when you look at like what their estimates for savings would be, the most on the range is like $1,200 And over the lifetime was basically like $750. I mean, it's like you can buy an Xbox or a PlayStation with the savings.
Perfect.
So while yes, they are using the terms correctly, there is dominance and then there is dominance. And $750, I think, is more like it's especially when again consider that they're using much higher quality data for theirs, and the focus is really on not doing a procedure when the procedure is not indicated versus like not doing the procedure and missing a catastrophic event. So, you know, they say that, you know, their discussion is already very muted. They're basically are like stronger. The second sentence is stronger data and cost estimates are needed. All right.
Yes,
well,
please.
Yeah. You know, don't take what we have to say, like, just don't apply to clinical practice. Just listen to what we have to tell you. You know, and they say, like, there's limited economic incentive in improving sensitivity, as most of the ACS economic burden lies in the lack of specificity. And probably, again, I think that they make that argument because the current standard of care approaches, you know, individual pressure measurements or with an ART line or whatever, are already pretty sensitive. Also, they didn't do any physical, there's no physical exam. Like, it's just purely based on their pressure measurement. So it's like, you're eliminating the clinical context from this as well. And once you add in clinical context with your pressure measurements, understanding the patient's trajectory, the appearance of the limb, the underlying injury, you can make more judicious call in terms of the procedure. This has a lot of assumptions and caveats that I think mute the clinical utility of the paper. I mean, at the end of the day, there's nothing to put on hold here other than, is the premise of the paper really a clinical paradigm that's confronting the zeitgeist or the soul of orthopedic trauma? And I don't think it is.
Not enough to move the needle.
Right. Like, what it's basically saying is, like, if you want to do their continuous pressure measurements and, you know, you went to the board exam part two, having done continuous pressure measurements, and they ask you about it, you can say, well, you know, it is the study from Buchluch et al, you know, showed that it was actually potentially dominant from a cost effective standpoint. And maybe wow your examiners. But outside of that, you know, it certainly doesn't support that, like, you should replace what you're doing if you're using the standard approaches.
Great. Can't add a whole lot to that. Well done. All right. I'm going to go something a little bit different here. We're going to talk about a prospective randomized comparison of functional bracing and spica casting for femoral fractures showed equivalent early outcomes. I basically don't need to present this article because I'm done. But it's by Andras et al, 3 for 30 days, and there's an infographic. As a resident, I spent many days in the emergency room, or many nights in the emergency room, putting spica casts on very unhappy kids. So I'm actually very happy to see this prospective randomized comparison of functional bracing and spica casting for femoral fractures. The biggest patient that I spica'd was a 16-year-old male who was bigger than me. Needless to say, it was not fun. So the AAOS clinical practice guidelines recommend spica casting for the treatment of femoral fractures in children 6 months to 5 years of age with less than 2 centimeters of shortening. But there are complications of hygiene, transport, and skin complications with spica casting. So the purpose of the study was to compare the outcomes of treatment with prefabricated braces, as opposed to custom braces, with those of spica casting, reducing the necessity potentially for anesthesia and operating room placement of the spica cast. Authors conducted a randomized prospective study of patients 6 months to 5 years within that AAOS clinical practice guideline timeframe who were managed with functional bracing or spica casting for the treatment of diaphyseal fractures at 2 pediatric trauma centers. They excluded comminuted and or high energy fractures, polytrauma, medical comorbidities impacting fracture healing, or less than 6 weeks of follow-up. And randomization was performed per site. So for spica casts, they were all placed in the operating room with the patient under general anesthesia by an attending physician. Functional braces, on the other hand, were placed at bedside with an orthotist and a member of the orthopedic team. It could be a resident, a fellow, a physician assistant, or the attending surgeon. Now, there are four standardized sizes for the functional bracing developed on the basis of measurements from prior patients who are managed with custom-made braces. You can make adjustments to the length or width of the cuff prior to application, and it would be templated from the contralateral leg. So even though an anesthetic or sedative was not used for functional bracing, weight-based analgesia, typically morphine, with or without a muscle relaxant, such as diazepam, were utilized. They used stockinette still when they were doing the functional bracing. It was cut to the length of the leg and placed while applying gentle traction for stabilization through the foot. And the brace was slid onto the torso and leg, which then were lowered into the brace. And they allowed for sitting. Flexion at the hip was fixed between 30 and 60 degrees. And abduction was fixed between 20 and 40 degrees to prevent slippage. At 4 weeks, the functional brace was unlocked at the hip joint to allow for more motion and ease of ambulation. They looked at radiographic union defined as callus that bridged the fracture at greater than or equal to 3 cortices. Non-union was diagnosed if bridging callus at 3 cortices was not evidenced by 12 weeks. Non-union was defined as greater than 30 degrees of varus or valgus, 30 degrees of procravatum, or greater than 15 millimeters of shortening in a patient aged 6 months to less than or equal to 2 years. 15 degrees of varus or valgus, greater than 20 degrees of procravatum, or greater than 20 millimeters shortening in a patient age greater than 2 years to 5 years. They used a pediatric outcomes data collection instrument, or a PODCI, as an additional custom questionnaire to assess functional outcomes and satisfaction at 6 weeks and 1 year after injury. The target sample size was 40 per group based on a 28% versus 5% rate of skin problems with 2 independent samples, alpha equals 0.05 and beta of 0.8. So 90 patients were initially randomized to be treated with the brace, with 45 in the brace and 45 in the SpikaCast. 9 patients did not complete the 6-week follow-up, and 1 was excluded because of a neuromuscular condition, leaving 80 patients for analysis, 40 in the Spica group, and 40 in the functional bracing group, which was their target sample size. Interestingly enough, 115 patients declined participation, so more declined participation than were enrolled in the study, which I find surprising because if bracing was the only other option and this is the only way of getting it, then I would probably be more likely to enroll, but who knows what the discussions were. The mean age in the casting group was 2 and 2.3 years in the bracing group, similar. The radiographs demonstrated similar shortening, varus angulation, and procravatum in the casting and bracing group. There were no intraoperative complications occurred during SpikaCast placement. All braces were successfully placed at bedside. There were brace issues, interestingly enough. 6 patients. They'd include unlocking of the brace at the hip was 1 patient, loosening was 1 patient, exchange of the brace for a larger size at the time of follow-up, 1 patient, mold development, tasty, 1 patient, and screw fallout, 2 patients. An additional patient removed the brace at 4 weeks at home without authorization, but there were no complications or changes in outcomes due to these issues. At 6 weeks, all 80 fractures healed. There were no differences in shortening, varus angulation, or procurvatum in both groups. There was no non-union. There was 1 malunion in the bracing group because the shortening was 4 millimeters greater than the criteria for malunion. In the casting group, in 1 person had rashes and mild skin breakdown. In the bracing group, 9 patients had rashes or mild skin breakdown. Because of the rash, 1 patient was started on oral antibiotics. 1 patient had skin irritation and a screw replaced in a brace. All skin issues did resolve with local wound care. 2 Spica casts were soiled and 3 needed cast wedging. They did those extra surveys. They were parental surveys. Only 54 of the 80 patients completed the parental survey. Parent satisfaction with treatment was high for both groups. 84% of patients in the casting group and 76% of the patients in the bracing group had 10 out of 10 scores. There were no differences between groups with the perception of the stressfulness of this experience. The ability to use the child's regular car seat was more limited in the casting group, 40% versus 86% in the bracing group. For parents reporting missing work, the median number of missed days was 17 days for casting and only 5 days for the bracing group, but were not significantly different. Parents reported that patients in the casting group had more difficulty moving independently versus the bracing group. At 1 year, 51 patients had 1 year follow-up, and there were no differences in terms of shortening, varus angulation, There was a slight difference in procurvatum. There was a little bit more procurvatum in the casting group than in the bracing group, of about almost 12 degrees versus 5 degrees. Only 30 parents completed the survey at the one-year follow-up. The satisfaction remained high in both groups, not different between groups. And looking at the PODCI scores at greater than 1 year, the bracing group reported almost no pain, and the score was better than the score. It was 99.5 versus 89.4 for the casting group. So less pain in the bracing group, but there were no really significant other differences between groups. So in this prospective randomized controlled trial, patients who were treated with functional bracing had equivalent outcomes to those who were treated with spica casting. Prefabricated functional braces provided a viable alternative, and avoided the cost of anesthesia, which, you know, in my residency, we didn't do all the spica casts in the operating room. We did some of those in the ED under sedation. So we didn't have to do that per se, but there is a lot of more work with the cast placement potentially than an off-the-shelf brace placement. So I like seeing prospective randomized controlled trial studies like this in the areas that can actually change clinical management. So I found this study of interest and could potentially change what we do for these femur fractures.
Yeah. I mean, the thought of being in a spica cast for a femur fracture sounds miserable. Unless it's the smallest of children who I feel like can adapt to just about anything. They're very pliable. Like anything over 4 years old, I just can't imagine.
So I'm with you. So yeah, hopefully a game changer in that way.
When I was in residency, we universally did all of them in the OR though.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Interesting. I
never did a spica cast in the ED.
I will say most of them were in the OR, but we definitely did ED ones.
You got to get that little like
the platform.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
We stole that definitely from the OR. Mm-hmm. All right. So now your case is on hold featurette. It's myocardial infarction prior to total knee arthroplasty is associated with increased risk of medical and surgical complications in a time-dependent manner. By Holly et al., there's a commentary and a visual summary. If a patient has an MI prior to a total knee replacement, do they do worse after surgery? Logically, one would say that increased comorbidities are more likely to correlate with worst postoperative outcomes. So already, this is just not a surprising find for me. The prevalence of myocardial infarction in general is high, with nearly 10% of the population greater than 60 years of age having experienced an MI. But there's minimal literature showing how previous MI influences outcomes after total knee arthroplasty. Previous studies evaluated the impact of preoperative MI on postoperative MI, but not necessarily other medical and surgical complications, which is what this study did. So they looked at postoperative cardiac complications, general medical complications, and surgical complications using the Pearl Diver database from 2010 to 2022. There is an implosion of these studies when it comes to more and more database studies. They identified primary TKA using CPT codes, and then they looked at ICD-10 procedural codes. If they had any infectious process, fracture, or malignancy prior to the index procedure, they were excluded. They did match laterality of surgical complications. Patients who underwent a contralateral TKA within 2 years after the index procedure were excluded. To limit transfer bias, only patients with active data for 2 years before and 2 years after the index procedure were included. Patients who experienced MI within 2 years before TKA were identified and were matched 1-4 with patients who have not had an MI. This was based on age, sex, LXI-Alzheimer's comorbidity index, and multiple comorbidities. Patients who had a prior MI were stratified into 4 groups based on the timing of MI: 0 to less than 6 months, 6 months to less than 12 months, 12 months to less than 18 months, and 18 months to 24 months before total knee replacement. They also looked at stratification of MI. There's a type 1 MI, which is acute plaque rupture and thrombosis. Type 2 MI is a mismatch between myocardial oxygen supply and demand. Patients who had a non-STEMI or a STEMI, which is a ST elevation MI. Patients who were treated with percutaneous coronary intervention and those who were not. Patients who were treated with guideline-directed medical therapy, which is DDMT, including beta blockers and those who were not. Patients were treated with dual antiplatelet therapy and those who were not. Patients who had anterior MI and those who had inferior MI. So basically, every single possible delineation and slicing of MI was evaluated here. And it looked at rates of postoperative cardiac, general, medical, and surgical complications, looking at 90 days and 2 years. And I did do the subgroup analysis based on the prior MI type, treatment, and location. So after matching, there were 8,810 patients who had a prior MI, with a control group of 34,905. Coronary artery disease, congestive heart failure, pacemaker placement were similar between groups. Prior MI was not surprisingly associated with increased risk of postoperative MI, heart failure, and 90-day mortality. The risk of postoperative MI was highest for those with MI within 6 months before total knee arthroplasty. The postoperative MI risk did decrease with increasing time between the prior MI and total knee replacement. Holt was linked to elevated postoperative MI and two-year mortality with timing closer to surgery, type 1 MI, STEMI, non-STEMI, and anterior and inferior MI. Patients who had a non-STEMI prior to total knee had a higher rates of acute kidney injury, heart failure, and pneumonia. Percutaneous coronary intervention within 6 months before total knee arthroplasty also had increased risk of postoperative MI, heart failure, and two-year mortality. Patients who had PCI within 1 year before total knee arthroplasty had significant higher rates of mortality. If you had greater than 1 year, the mortality risk was no different than controls. Type 2 MI within 6 months of total knee had an increased risk of periprosthetic joint infection compared to controls. The same type 2 MI patients had higher rates of heart failure, but no differences in postoperative MI or mortality. Patients who had a prior MI without PCI had higher rates of postoperative MI, heart failure, and two-year mortality compared to controls up to 18 months between MI and total knee arthroplasty. Patients who were given the guideline-directed medical therapy, including beta blockers after a prior MI, continue to have higher rates of postoperative MI and 90-day mortality. Patients who have been prescribed this GDTM after an MI 0 to 6 months prior to total knee arthroplasty had a higher rate of infection and 90-day mortality compared with controls. Patients who had an MI within 18 months before total knee arthroplasty had increased risk of two-year mortality compared to controls. Only patients with an anterior MI within 6 months before total knee arthroplasty and those with an inferior MI within 12 months before total knee arthroplasty had an increased risk of postoperative MI. That was a lot of words. There's all these different time frames, and in theory, you could use
it. So dense and chewy.
Very, very dense, very chewy. And whether that's going to help you say, well, you're 6 months from your surgery, your MI, I'm going to hold off. It makes for very convoluted guidelines. So
honestly, there's no guideline here. It's just like we did every possible iteration that we could think of myocardial infarction and outcome, like every possible moving shell game parameter, and just report everything that we find, and here you go. And it was done with Pearl Diver and its claims-based data. I mean, what in your practice is somebody has a history of MI, and what in your practice, when that patient comes in and they need a total knee, besides getting the cardiac clearance, and I do want to come back to that, like, what else is it? Like, what else is there?
Typically, you wait at least 6 months before any MI. Yeah. So that's just a good guideline. And if you'll be really safe, you wait a year. But 6 months is kind of just already a known factor that everyone basically follows, I would say.
Okay. So, I mean, what I think here is that, like, they completely missed opportunities, right? Because they're doing propensity score matching, which is a causal inference technique, and there isn't real causal inference in their motivating hypothesis. Patients who did not have an MI prior to the index procedure were propensity matched with those who did. So you're basically, like, if we look at this as a randomized trial, you're randomizing people to MI or not, right? But that's not a causal inference. What they could have done that I thought would have been more interesting would have been do propensity score matching around the guideline-directed management. So you know the patient's already had a heart attack. Propensity score match on that piece, or propensity score match on the MI location even, although I think that's a little bit less. But certainly the PCI, how about?
Yeah.
PCI, right? And that's one of their take-home points that they infer. They were like, well, the patients with PCI have a higher risk of adverse events because it's probably more severe Well, you could have drilled down on that by making that the focus of the study instead of this big kind of patients who had MI versus those who didn't. Those who didn't versus those who did is not really a good comparison, because you can't tell a patient, well, you know, your outcomes are so much worse as compared to this other person who didn't have the condition that you have. That goes back to our Donnie Brasco paradigm, right? Like, the person who had an MI wants to talk about their unique clinical context. You don't bring in like, well, if you didn't have the MI, well, they did have the MI. So talking about them not having the MI, how does that help anything, right? So, you know, all of these comparisons that they're making within the context of just the propensity score match is not addressing any of this stuff. It's just subset analyses of the group. They could have done a causal inference test that would have had value. In this case, it's just this group versus that group. Here's the outcome. These ones infection, these ones mortality, these ones whatever it may be, you know, mortality at a different time point. And it just becomes this like litany of outcomes, 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 outcomes. And there's no cogent, like, okay, what are we supposed to do with this? So what do they tell you you're supposed to do with this? What's the concluding statement? It highlights the importance of optimizing the timing and obtaining cardiac clearance. Now, which one of these patients, these thousands of patients that were done, or even just the ones that, you know, were in the match, the 8,860 patients who had an MI within 2 years before the total knee, how many of those patients do you think didn't have cardiac clearance? I would say it's zero. I'd be shocked if it was anything other than they all got cardiac clearance.
They did. Didn't change a thing. And that's the thing.
But that's not what cardiac clearance is for. Cardiac clearance is to provide, it's to some degree, medical legal coverage, and to see if there's anything you can do to optimize the patient to the fullest extent possible, such that you're having the lowest risk. It's not no risk. It's not minimal risk. It's not better risk as compared to the person who doesn't have a heart problem or heart history. It's just the lowest risk possible. So telling us that we should, your conclusion being get cardiac clearance is the absolute greatest non sequitur of all time, as far as I'm concerned.
It sounds like an orthopedic answer, like ANSEF.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when it comes to like that kind of thing too, like I have a whole soapbox around just the social media popular conception of like orthopedic surgeons as complete morons and like knuckle dragging Neanderthal types. Because just look at the board scores and the performance rates of people who go into orthopedic surgery for probably the last 3 decades, if not more. And it is among the most competitive specialties. You have very smart people in orthopedics. Sure. And the whole like ortho bro culture, again, is, you know, you worked in this department here in Boston, and I know the people in your department in Texas. Are there people who work out? Yeah. Are there ortho bro? I don't know a single, I couldn't name you an ortho bro actually anywhere that I know of. I don't know anyone like that. And I know a lot of people in orthopedics.
I do work out. Is that okay?
Yeah, no, I work out too, but it's not working out. It's like this sort of, you know, amalgamation between like Cro-Magnon man and like a California surfer sort of into this like stereotype of like all you care about is how much you bench and like doing scopes or something, or I don't, you know what I mean? Like it's just it's the stereotype is silly. The idea that orthopedic surgeons are not smart people is patently absurd. And then when it comes back to this, like, oh, like all they care about is ANSEF and say get cardiac clearance. I mean, I don't agree with that either. But when you write that, you're not helping things by writing it in at the end of your paper. I'll tell you that.
No, definitely not. Completely agree. All right. Excellent.
Now for some honorable mentions. The future is mobile. Pilot validation study of Apple Health Metrics and Orthopedic Trauma by Brodke et al. There's a commentary and it's free for 30 days. This study evaluated the ability of Apple Health to track mobility after lower extremity fractures in 107 patients. There was a 93% reduction in daily step count from the pre-injury period to the immediate post-injury period. And other gait parameters also showed increased impairment from pre-injury to post-injury.
not surprisingly. However, by 6 months, step count improved sixfold relative to the immediate post-injury period, but still remained 52% below baseline. PROMIS physical function correlated moderately with step count and weakly with other gait parameters. Patients with a known non-union had a 55% slower recovery of step count than those without a non-union. The Apple Health mobility parameters captured changes in mobility following lower extremity fracture and throughout the subsequent recovery period, also distinguishing between non-unions and unions. A deep learning-based clinical classification system for differential diagnosis of hip prosthesis failures using radiographs, a multi-center study by Wu et al. A deep learning-based clinical classification system called HipNet was developed to classify multiple causes of total hip arthroplasty failure, including periprosthetic joint infection, aseptic loosening, dislocation, periprosthetic fracture, and polyethylene wear. The HipNet demonstrated strong generalizability across different settings, effectively distinguishing between five common types of hip prosthesis failures with an accuracy of 0.904 and an area under the receiving operating characteristic curve, or AUC, of 0.937, which is quite high in the external cohort. The model generated individual PJI risk scores exhibited a positive correlation with C-reactive protein level and erythrocyte sedimentation rate. And finally, comparing the in vitro efficacy of commonly used surgical irrigants for the treatment of implant-associated infections by Hamad et al., which is permanently free. This study compared the efficacy of surgical irrigants in vitro against Staph aureus alone and in combination with Candida albicans in both planktonic and biofilm states. Full-strength Dakin solution, 0.35% povidone iodine, 10% povidone iodine, 3% hydrogen peroxide, and a one-to-one combination of 10% povidone iodine and 3% hydrogen peroxide, Irrecept, Experience, Bactisure, and normal saline solutions were tested. The combination of povidone iodine and hydrogen peroxide and Bactisure were the only irrigants to eradicate Staph aureus in both planktonic and biofilm states. The povidone iodine and hydrogen peroxide combination was the only irrigant to eradicate polymicrobial Staph aureus and C. albicans bioburden in both states. Thanks so much for dialing in. We look forward to seeing you next time.